Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Jane Clayson, and for Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. The news was bittersweet. The family of retired Supreme Court Justice Sandra Day O'Connor disclosed last week that her husband of 55 years has struck up a romance with a fellow Alzheimer's patient. O'Connor's son Scott told the NBC affiliate in Phoenix that his mother is not jealous, quite the opposite.
Mom, you know, was thrilled that Dad was relaxed and happy and comfortable living here and wasn't complaining. For Mom to visit when he's happy, you know, visiting with his girlfriend, sitting on the porch swing holding hands, no stress on Mom, no guilt laid on Mom.
The O'Connors are not alone. Many other families are in the same boat, and not just with Alzheimer's or other diseases. New scientific studies show the brain changes over time and affects the way we love. Experts say old love is different from young love, and not necessarily for the worse. This hour On Point, how time changes love. Joining me now from New York is Robin DeSell. She's a clinical social worker and director of special care services at the Hebrew Home at Riverdale in New York. Since 1995, the Hebrew Home has had a policy on residents' rights and sexual expression. Welcome to you, Robin.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
And with us also from Santa Monica, California, is Dr. Gary Small. He is a psychiatrist and director of the Center on Aging at UCLA. He's author of The Memory Bible. Hello to you, Dr. Small.
Hi, Jane. I'm delighted to be here.
Thank you. Robin, let me start with you. I'm interested what your reaction was to the Sandra Day O'Connor story.
I believe that Justice O'Connor's actions on behalf of her husband were both noble and selfless. I know that this was not easy for herself or her family, not an easy thing to see, not an easy thing to feel, but the fact that she was able to separate herself, get enough distance to understand and appreciate the fact that her husband was not necessarily betraying her marriage or betraying their former lives together, but more living in the moment, and had found someone who he could share his moments with, share his days with, that she could fully appreciate and understand that and almost feel grateful for it. Mm.
Dr. Small, through the lens of your professional work, what did you think?
Well, I think it's a very touching example of more mature love that we often see as we age. The fact that there wasn't a sense of betrayal, that she was not jealous, I think speaks to that she is beyond the more immature love that many people have initially. When you think about romance and love, there are really several different components. There's sex and physical attraction, there's romantic love, and there's attachment that we develop to a long-term partner. And different parts of our brains will drive these different aspects of love. And it goes against the assumption that if somebody has Alzheimer's disease, they're not capable of love.
Hmm. Interesting. From your experience, Robin, how common is the Sandra Day O'Connor scenario in facilities like yours?
I do believe that this is something that's going to come to bear more fully as time goes on. We don't per se keep a count, if you will, but this is going to be a phenomenon that we will see more and more. It will be a growing trend. I think that the issue that needs to come to bear is the fact that with a dementia diagnosis, there is so much, there's compound loss. Memories fade away, cognition fades away, identity fades away. But feelings never fade away. Mm. It's just sometimes the players change out, and again, not out of an act of betrayal, mm-hmm. but because someone with a dementia diagnosis lives in a different world. They're no longer in the world they lived in before. They're now in a separate place, and they respond more to their visual day-to-day experience than to the luxury of the past, because that is lost. Mm.
Tell us about your facility specifically and the policies that you have put into place to deal with situations like the Sandra Day O'Connor scenario. I think it's fascinating what you all have done there.
Thank you, certainly. Back in the early 90s, the Hebrew home readily recognized the fact that there were multiple issues coming to bear in the way of resident care. It was as though the imperative of clinical care had now expanded, and we had to factor in quality of life. And that was for residents who were cognitively intact, as well as the ever-growing number of residents with a dementia diagnosis. We came together as an interdisciplinary group representing our research department, nursing, social services, therapeutic activities, nurses' aides, families, representatives that could look at the issue of resident rights. And the prompt for all of this really was the fact that there were relationships that were occurring on our memory care neighborhoods, which is what we reference for dementia care. So in evaluating or assessing those relationships, we didn't want to simply assign the act of two residents coming together in an intimate relationship as being behavioral. It wasn't an outgrowth necessarily of behavior, but of human need and the need for intimacy and connection and belonging. We came together for an extended period of time as a group, and we formulated a policy on resident rights to sexual expression and intimacy. Again, not as though we're promoting sex. What we are doing is sanctioning the fact that residents are people. They continue to have the same plethora of human needs that they did prior to the onset of a diagnosis, and they are now living in long-term care, which needs to translate to being their home. Mm-hmm. And we wanted to respect and support their right to be involved in a relationship. What better medicine?
Dr. Small, help us understand what happens in the mind of an Alzheimer's patient, a dementia patient, as it relates to love and relationships.
It's complex. Mm-hmm. I mean, a lot of things happen to the brain as it ages, and particularly as someone develops Alzheimer's disease, there's a loss of the connections between brain cells. So the brain wiring goes wrong, and the first thing to be affected is short-term memory. Often people will have long-term memories but forget what they had for breakfast or forget what they had for lunch. As the disease progresses, they stop recognizing people who they know who are important to their lives. So it does get into long-term memories as well.
And the desire for intimacy persists even when everything else has been stolen.
That's right. It does persist. And it's interesting because when we study the parts of the brain that respond to different forms of love, there's a part of the brain deep in the brain called the caudate nucleus that is controlling passionate love, which is a very strong feeling. In fact, it's more powerful than sexual drive. And it is the same neural circuitry that controls addiction to drugs or alcohol or food. So many people often feel physical withdrawal when they cannot get together with their loved one. Mm-hmm. It's also interesting that when we look at what happens to the Alzheimer brain, the caudate nucleus is not a part of the brain that really is affected as much as other parts of the brain in the cortical outside rim. Mm.
I guess what was striking to me about the O'Connor story as I heard about it was there was this sort of, at a time of such difficulty, there was a poignancy and a real richness to this relationship of a 55-year marriage between a couple and this man who did not recognize his wife anymore, and yet she still supported him. She still goes to see him. She still loves him in some way. Dr. Small, you know, how do you explain that?
Well, it speaks to several things going on. One thing that's going on in the justice's brain is that she has reached an ability to experience a higher form of love, attachment to a long-term partner. It's beyond just romantic love. Mm-hmm. So it's something that makes her want the love object to experience good things. It's not just about how she feels, but it's how the other person feels. So it's a form of empathy, which is typical of a more mature brain, that it's able to experience empathy. And the other thing it tells us is that patients with Alzheimer's disease still have the ability to experience romantic love. That part of the brain is not destroyed, at least in the moderate stage of the disease and even sometimes in the more severe stages.
Do you see these reactions, Robin DeSalle, in your home, reactions like Sandra Day O'Connor is having with her husband, this sort of empathy that Dr. Small suggests?
Absolutely so. I think for the family and particularly for a spouse, there are so many factors that are operating simultaneously. It much depends upon where the individual is in the illness process and how long the family has borne the responsibility of caregiving and what the relationship was pre-existing the onset of a dementia diagnosis. Families will react in a variety of ways. The variance is great. There are many who are at the point that Justice O'Connor was, where she could be selfless and she could do what is probably the premier act of oversight for someone that she does love and care for, and that is, as I said, to take a step away and to support his health and his well-being and his happiness. Mm-hmm. There are other families who just are not there yet.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
In due respect, they deserve time to be able to wrap themselves around the situation. Mm-hmm. There are so many variables operating, and it's our responsibility to try to support both the resident and the family.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about intimacy, closeness, connections, and that crazy little thing called love, how it changes over the years and is changed by illness and disease for so many as we grow older. In the 2006 movie Away From Her, Julie Christie plays a woman with Alzheimer's named Fiona, who strikes up a relationship with Aubrey, a fellow patient. In this scene, Fiona's distressed husband visits her in the nursing home and inquires about her new relationship. We hear first from Fiona.
Well, I better go and see to Aubrey. He'll be wanting a little walk around, I suppose. It was nice chatting. You'll be back again tomorrow, I suppose.
Fiona, what are you doing? What are you doing with Aubrey?
He doesn't confuse me. He doesn't confuse me at all.
It was a scene from the 2006 movie Away From Her. We're talking this hour with Robin DeSalle. She's a clinical social worker and director of special care services at the Hebrew Home at Riverdale in New York. And with Dr. Gary Small, professor of psychiatry and biobehavioral sciences at UCLA. He's author of The Longevity Bible. Robin, before the break, you were talking a little bit about family reactions. And as we hear in that clip, I just think about the many different reactions that there must be. Anger and betrayal when love changes and people forget, yet intimacy moves on to someone else. Have you seen that side of it, the sort of darker side of the family reaction?
Certainly. I appreciate the reference, though. Truly, it's not the darker side. I think that there is so much affront when you have a family member with a diagnosis of dementia because of the longevity factor. It's a condition that can last from 7 to 15 years in its lifespan, and it takes an extraordinary toll on a family unit, whether they're the ones doing the direct caregiving or not, so that by the time someone comes into long-term care, or even if they're still in the community and there is a relationship with someone outside of the family unit or outside of the marriage, it's yet another affront. It's compound loss. It's the family trying to untangle day by day and year by year all of the emotion that they're feeling and bearing witness to so much loss, and with all that they give to then be at the receiving end of what could very well be felt to be a betrayal, because your mate no longer relates to you. And I think Fiona said it beautifully. He doesn't confuse me. Mm. The individual with the dementia does not live in our world as he or she did before. They are in a radically different place, and while we may not always understand or know that place, there seems to be an ability to connect with others who are in comparable places.
Dr. Small, understanding the disease and accepting its consequences are two very different matters, aren't they?
They really are, and these are very complex issues because often we tend to think of the brain and human nature and behavior in a simplistic way. Either somebody's jealous or they're not. Either they're in love or they're not. But it's very subtle. And even when someone is forgiving and loving of an Alzheimer patient and happy that they are in a new relationship, there are going to be mixed feelings. There may be some subtle feelings of betrayal. There may be a sense of guilt that they hadn't really been the kind of love partner they should have been, and now they're trying to make up for it. So I think it's important to get the right information about what's happening to one's relative and try to deal with one's own feelings and the complexity of them.
Are there scenarios, Robin DeSalle, where families might demand that a new couple be separated, despite the fact that perhaps a new relationship can even be therapeutic for their loved one?
There have been, in actuality, though the separation usually does not come to bear. What happens in the interim is that the staff meet with the family on a repeat basis and trying to help them almost depersonalize what's happened with their relative who's involved in another intimate relationship. But you need to allow the family time to work through what it is that they're feeling, the anger, the frustration, the betrayal, any range of emotion, and to acknowledge and validate their feelings, but to help them separate and to look in on their relative who, quite frankly, is in a very different time and place, and to try to hold the relative or measure that relative against our value system or our standards no longer applies. And more often than not, the family will take that step back and they'll recognize the fact that their relative needs the familiarity factor. They need to be in familiar and safe settings where there's relationships with caregivers, where there are relationships with other peers, and they're able to make the transition. When not, we will go the route of a separation, though not necessarily with our clinical sanction.
Interesting. Let's go to the phones now for a call from Janet, who is in Boston. Hi, Janet. Welcome to you.
Hi, Jane. How are you?
Hi. Well, thank you.
Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I couldn't help but call in for this one. I have a mother who is in an Alzheimer's unit in the area, and I just wanted to say, too, I started a conversation with my husband last night. The best thing about my mom's dementia is, and it made me laugh because I started thinking, wait a minute, this is odd. But I have to say that my mother historically has been, I would say a difficult person on many levels. She's had a long psychiatric history, now combined with the Alzheimer's. But most of her life, she was pretty argumentative and also, you know, it's difficult to say, but she has a history of being, I guess you could say anti-Semitic. And it has been very tough for our family historically. I mean, it's something that I've had to deal with, and it's been very unpleasant on many levels for me, having grown up with that. And what I wanted to comment about is that her best friend currently, where she lives right now, who I would say provides her with the most support, and they support each other, is a Jewish man who is he keeps kosher. He sits right next to her at the table, and they chat with each other, and she helps him, and she sticks up for him, and they hold hands, and they sit on the sofa and watch TV together. And I would say it's more of a friendship, but it's probably one of the best things I've seen in her. And it's almost uplifting to see this friendship that's so real and so pure, and it's just wonderful, and it's very uplifting. So I say the best thing about my mom's dementia is, and it sounds kind of funny, but it really is a wonderful thing.
Well, it's a wonderful story. Janet, thank you so much for your call. I appreciate it. Dr. Small, what an interesting story. Will you comment on it?
Really, it is so interesting. Yeah. I thought I'd heard everything. Now I see the headline, Alzheimer's disease cures anti-Semitism. But it's very poignant, and it's what we see often is that there are personality changes as a disease sets in. And in some situations, as we heard here, that there's a mellowing of the personality, but it doesn't always go in that direction. Sometimes people get worse. Sometimes a person who may be suspicious becomes outright paranoid. We're talking about romantic love setting in. Sometimes people become sexually inappropriate, and there are problems in some nursing home settings where men in particular may be making inappropriate sexual gestures, and it's a difficulty with the staff and other residents.
I'd like to bring another voice into our conversation now. Joining us from Milwaukee, Wisconsin is Ann Basting. She's director of the Center on Age and Community at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee, and she's also associate professor of theater at the Peck School of Arts. Welcome to you, Ann. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
What's your personal view of aging, and how is it different from how our culture views it?
Well, I also just want to take a second and say what a delight it is to hear the story that the caller just shared with us, because I actually feel like that's more of a common story than we hear, that the place that Robin so beautifully describes as the other world where people with dementia reside is a place that we might want to spend more time and to get to know. It's a place that's deeply in the present moment. And I think that we have such deep fears wrapped around the experience of dementia that we stay away to the point of sort of pathology. People with dementia tend to live in severe isolation because their loved ones on a larger scale in a term of love, family members on the whole, friends who've loved them their whole lives, community, it all fades away and breaks apart. So I think we have some deep thinking to do about love in general, about how we as a community and families and people love people with dementia.
In fact, you do exercises with some of your patients that start with the language, let's imagine, not let's remember, which I thought was so interesting.
Yeah, I think people often hear that I'm a professor of theater and wonder, what the heck does that have to do with dementia? But it's really about using the arts in an applied way to open communication. Because as we've said today, the emotional life of people with dementia is still very present. And the arts are an emotional, are a way to communicate through emotions rather than rational language. So one of the programs that I've developed is called Time Slips, which begins with a picture, and people simply, a facilitator simply asks people to respond to it and say, we're not going to focus on what you remember, but let's focus on what we can imagine and build a new story together. And I think that's sort of symbolic of what you, with the capacities that do remain, that you can build things in the present with people with dementia, not necessarily, you know, tell a coherent chronological story of the past.
Your husband is a documentary filmmaker, and I was interested to read that he actually spent a year in nursing homes. And what did he witness along these lines?
He did a film, Brad Lichtenstein did a film called Almost Home, which was broadcast on PBS, I believe, last year. And one of the storylines actually follows the budding new romance in the nursing home. Mm-hmm. It's a little bit of a different situation in that the couple was living in independent living in the same campus, and the wife had a very difficult time visiting the nursing home for, again, grieving process and fears and all kinds of things that, that Robin was mentioning people wrestle with, and just would not visit him as he had to move to the nursing home because of his Parkinson's and his worsening dementia. And he finds somebody who makes him happy and comforts him and whom he can comfort and care for. I think one of the things we haven't mentioned is that people with dementia lose a sense of purpose and usefulness. And if you can be comforting to someone else, you feel as though you matter. Mm. And I think that's really important, and that's what we saw in the relationship in Almost Home.
In your work, Anne, with your patients, do you actually see the arts as helping them progress in their illness, as far as making them better? Are they progressing in a good way, or is it just a comfort to them, allowing them to live better in the moment?
We've done a lot of evaluation around lots of different kinds of arts and the way the arts can be used with people with dementia. We don't tend to focus on whether or not their what's called their mini mental score, which Dr. Small knows all about, will improve or not. This is multiple diseases sometimes, multiple types of dementia, all compounded and very difficult to unpack to see if that would have a benefit for that. But we look at whether it improves their quality of life, and particularly whether it improves the relationship between the staff interactions, staff attitudes toward people with dementia, and the quality of life and the affect of the people going through the experience themselves. And we found that it really does have that kind of an impact.
I'd like to go to the phones again to take one of many calls that we have waiting. Susan is in Medford, Massachusetts. Hi, Susan. Welcome.
Hello, Jane. How are you?
Hi. Good. Go ahead. What's your question?
Well, my question kind of revolves around the people who are presently caregivers. And while Justice O'Connor was a magnanimous individual in allowing the situation to occur as it did and go with it, there are so many families where that caregiver in that primary role is so engrossed in the situation. How do or what is the best way for them to cope with not quite the Sandra Day O'Connor situation, but letting go themselves? How do you distance yourself from the scenario enough to say, I can let them go? What is the best route to help that caregiver?
Terrific question, Susan. I really appreciate your call. Robin DeSalle, do you want to tackle that?
I do. Thank you. I very much appreciate the question, because this is extraordinarily difficult. As I said earlier, what we need to first do is make certain that the family reaches out to someone for help and for support, someone they trust or someone who is neutral enough that can help the family validate what it is that they're feeling, and then perhaps get some distance by looking at what is happening with their relative. The memory of the relationship that pre-existed the onset of dementia, that's sacred. That can't be taken away. That is treasured. That is there now and forever. But where their relative is right now, if there are involvements that exist outside of the family unit, the idea is to help the family understand where their relative is. As I said before, and I don't want to be redundant, but it truly is another realm. It is another world. It's the day-to-day experience. The individual is being liberated in some way from their past because it's already been taken from them. So now the family is saying, yes, I see that. I understand. I appreciate. You need to be happy in your new place. And it's all about letting go throughout life. It's about parents letting go of children and helping them be able to grow and develop. Same thing now.
Let me bring Gary Small in. Dr. Small, I have about 30 seconds. Do you want to comment on this?
Yeah, I think there are several tasks for caregivers. They need to mourn the loss of the person they once knew. And it's very important, because caring for an Alzheimer patient puts that caregiver at risk for depression. At least 50% get depressed. Mm-hmm. They need to take care of themselves, and they need to think of strategies of ways they can still connect to their loved one.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson, in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about love and relationships and intimacy and how those feelings change and endure as we grow older. We're speaking this hour with Dr. Gary Small, director of the Center on Aging at UCLA, and Basting, director of the Center on Age and Community at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee, and with Robin DeSalle, director of Special Care Services at the Hebrew Home at Riverdale in New York. And I'll ask, do you think society romanticizes young love at the expense of mature love?
I think we do. I think that it's I think it sells. Mm-hmm. I think that's what the majority of what we see in the media. It's the majority of you know, films and television and it's based on, you know, old demographics and old notions that I think are definitely starting to change a little more slowly than we'd like, probably. But it is starting to change. We're starting to see, I mean, the fact that Away From Her came out at all is pretty miraculous. And I think we're starting to see a big shift in what we can imagine in conversations that we're having about late life, the importance of love, intimacy, and even sex in late life.
I was struck by the comment and appreciated it earlier in the program that young love is about wanting to be happy and old love is about wanting someone else to be happy. Dr. Small, tell us about brain research and how older people may be better equipped to deal with the emotional vicissitudes of love, if you will.
We always think an aging brain is a bad thing, and it is in many ways. Certainly our memory is not as good as when we're younger. But in many ways, an older brain is a better brain because it is more complex, there's more experience, and it's more mature. We talked about empathy. If you look at empathy in a teenage brain has a lot of difficulty being empathic, whereas as we get older, we're able to put ourselves in another person's place and understand their perspective. And I think that's definitely leading to a higher form of love. Other studies have also found that an older person tends to see the cup half full rather than half empty, which is critically important and a big part in successful aging. I have a whole chapter on it in the Longevity Bible about how we can become more optimistic so we can live better longer.
And how do these changes at the end of life when it comes to romance and relationships, how do these end of life relationships, what do they teach us about life itself?
Well, I think one very important lesson is that the very intense sexual drive and attachment we feel towards someone else is not permanent. And a more permanent form of love stems from romantic love, where we have a long-term attachment to a partner, where we care about them over time. The sexual drive may not be as great, although now with new pharmacology and Viagra, people are definitely very sexually active into later times in their life. But I think we're learning that it is these companionships and the connectedness to someone we feel intimate about that is critically important. And the studies on successful aging show that if you are socially connected, you're going to live longer and live better.
Mm-hmm. Back to the phones now to our listeners. Tom is in Harrisonburg, Virginia. Hi, Tom. Welcome.
Hi.
Hi. Go ahead. What's your question?
Yeah, I had worked at a retirement home when I was in high school for about 4 years.
Mm-hmm.
And spent some time with Alzheimer's patients. And the nurse discovered one time, she was telling me that this woman had Alzheimer's. She found them, her and this other gentleman in the Alzheimer's unit, sleeping together. And I also worked with the woman's husband on the non-Alzheimer's section. And the nurses didn't know what to do because this woman had severe Alzheimer's. She was really bad. And this poor man, every time I saw him, it broke my heart because the situation was so tough, but the nurses ended up not telling the woman's husband. So I just wanted to know what situation like that. Mm.
All these difficult decisions, Tom, thanks. Robin DeSell, how do you make these calls, these decisions?
Families, well, it is difficult. Families truly are partners in care, and you would look for disclosure. It's important because in some way or other, that gentleman may have come upon the two as a couple, and you would like at least to have the opportunity as staff to help the individual work through what it is that he might be feeling when coming upon this reality, this new realization. It's all about turning the tide, whether it be baby boomers down the pike, whether it be 10 years back, whether it be right now at the present moment in time. The important piece in all of this is that love and healthy aging and wellness, they carry far into life through to the latter stages of life and even beyond. And we are here to protect and preserve that. It is important to help a family understand. It is important to share information. It's also important to preserve a relationship that may, in fact, be what is carrying those two residents with dementia through maybe the most challenging point in their lives.
Let's go back to the phones for another call from Gail, who's in Williamsburg, Virginia. Hi, Gail. Welcome to you.
Thank you very much. My position relates to your early question or statement that perhaps society puts more emphasis on young love and almost denigrates old love or mature love. And I am in a relatively new relationship, 3 years almost now. I'm 67. He's 75. The family, the friends of him and his wife, that couple felt that he had no business relating to another person. That it you know, destroyed her memory. It ruined her memory, and it cheapened everything. And it was just the reverse. I helped him through. I've been a bereavement counselor, and I've helped him get his health back straightened out.
Gail, thank you for your experience. I really appreciate your call. Dr. Small, do you want to respond to that kind of a scenario?
Well, this is 180 degrees different from what we see with Sandra Day O'Connor's family, where there's suspiciousness. There's this assumption that older people can't experience love again. And I think it's an unfortunate scenario. I'm optimistic that things are changing. This overvaluing of youth in our culture, I think, is baby boomers are coming of age and there's a graying of America, that there is more emphasis in the media and public attention on positive older role models. So I think things may very well change.
Ann Basting, do you want to comment on that call?
Yeah, I think that one of the first things when we encounter resistance, or even with the, you know, when the first whole story of the Sandra Day O'Connor story broke, one of the first questions I thought of is, why is this coming out as a story? It's because we're seeing this in some way as scandalous or shocking. And what's at the root of that? Is it the assumption that it is betrayal, or and what are the emotions at the root of that? And in the caller situation, you know, the family should ask, what is the root of my hesitation? Is it that I don't want things to change? I'm not willing to let my father change and continue to grow as he grows older. I want him to stay the same as he was, because that's how I identify with him. That is really sometimes some of our greatest hesitation about seeing older adults as vital, growing human beings, is that we want them to stay the way that they were for some reason. The earlier call was even more interesting, because it's acknowledging that sometimes changes that can take place in dementia can actually, people can grow and change for the better. So I think we have a lot of thinking to do about our own hesitations and our own reluctance to let things change for parents in particular.
Robin DeSalle, would you agree with that? People looking at their own motivations as it relates to older intimacy in dementia cases or not in sort of regular life.
I do, wholeheartedly. Please, I do want to state the fact that the reason I believe that there is a premium on youth is because there is fear relative to the aging process and infirmity, and a presumption that once a person reaches a certain point in time, it's all over, and that there is no life pleasure, there is no life choice, there is no happiness, there is no potential, that all is over and done until the bitter end. I do believe at this point in time that society perhaps is more receptive to understanding that there is more life to live. And that's what we're trying to do now, is humanize the aging process and dementia and all of the corollary conditions that go along with it. Just to help to understand that there is life. It may not be measured against the current life pleasures that have value now, but it is just as meaningful. It just translates and plays out differently.
Robin, thank you. Back to the lines now. The phone's in Scott, who's in Portsmouth, Rhode Island. Hi, Scott. Welcome.
Hi, Jane. How are you?
Hi. Good. Thanks.
Good. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure. What's your question?
Well, I'll try and frame it as a question, but here's the event that has occurred. My 83-year-old father got married a month ago to an 80-year-old woman after my mother died a year and a half ago.
What was your reaction to that?
It's been incredible, it's been inspiring, and I never, the love that blossomed out of that, it has been absolutely incredible.
Did that surprise you in some ways?
Well, it did. It did because, he had such a deep, and my mother was an incredible woman. They were married for 59 years. And so I was concerned that my older sister, somebody told me that daughters often have a hard time dealing with their father's remarrying, but my older sister really rallied, and she got to know the woman that he married, and we all just feel like it's been a net positive, and it's been an incredible event. But I've been married 23 years, and I have three kids, 17, 15, and 13, and my wife now tells me that she no longer wants to have a relationship with me, and so my marriage is on the verge of disintegrating, so it's almost like a cruel hoax, I feel like, in a way.
Well, I sure appreciate your time and your thoughts, and wish you the best. Dr. Small, I guess that brings up a question on one level, Scott's call about gender. Do men and women deal with older age differently or react to it differently?
Well, I think women probably do better as they age than men. In fact, they live longer, and at the same time, they do have a slightly higher risk for getting Alzheimer's disease. But when we hear from Scott's situation, there are some interesting issues that come up. The idea that a parent is in love with someone else, this is something very positive. I think this is a natural reaction. When we care about somebody and they're having a good time and they're in a good place, those feelings are infectious and we like it and we're happy for them. We care about them. But for many children, there are concerns about inheritance, or there may be a past conflictual relationship. Maybe that adult child is jealous of the love that the parent is giving towards this this new relationship. So I think it's, and of course in Scott's situation where he is facing divorce and the loss of his relationship brings up other issues. So I think there's a complexity to all these interactions, and we've got to try to sort it out so we can do the best thing for our partners and our family members.
Mm. Thank you. Back to the lines now for another call from Trish, who's in Duxbury, Massachusetts. Hi, Trish. Welcome to you.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
This is a terrific subject. My mom passed away a few years ago. She had been diagnosed with Alzheimer's, and I was one of her primary caregivers. She had early Alzheimer's and had it for 6 years. And in the early stages, it was the most horrific experience that we have ever, as a collective family, experienced. She was violent. She was attempted to kill my father, who was alive and well, several times. She stayed at home, and she passed away at home. But the greatest gift we got from her dementia was, growing up, she was never a demonstrative of her love. That we grew up in an Irish family, so we knew we were loved, but it was never mentioned. And as she progressed in her Alzheimer's, she was, anyone who would listen, she told that all of her family had died. The six kids had died, their children had died, and my father had died. And then She would proceed to tell people what this really wonderful man she's living with now, she thinks is going to ask her to marry him. And she had fallen head over heels with this man, who just happened to be her husband. And it was a wonderful, tender ending to her life where he would come in the room and she would just become so coy and shy. And it was a lovely, lovely gift.
Tricia, thank you for that lovely story. I appreciate you calling. Anne Basting, you want to give a final comment to that story or something else?
I love that story. And I think, again, it's a way we don't often talk about the gifts or, you know, things that we can grow through with the experience of dementia. And that's one of them. There's a couple great stories I can point people to. One is a book by Eleanor Fuchs called Making an Exit, which is a similar story of her mother, who was a hard international businesswoman who, with the experience of dementia, which was horrific in the beginning as well for them, became one of the most loving, demonstratively, openly loving people. And it was incredible experience for Eleanor. And there's also a film called, an old film, really, over 10 years old now, called Complaints of a Dutiful Daughter, that charts a similar course. I think these stories are becoming more common now.
Thank you so much, Anne Basting, Director of the Center on Age and Community at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee. I appreciate your time.
Thank you for having me.
Robin DeSalle, Director of Special Care Services at the Huber Home at Riverdale in New York. Thanks so much, Robin.
My pleasure. Thank you.
And Dr. Gary Small, Director of the Memory and Aging Research Center at UCLA. Thank you, Doctor.
Thanks, Jane.
Wonderful hour. I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.